Welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Friday, April 19th, 2024. I'm your reader, Grace Barter. Iowa's first tornadoes of 2024 arrived with Tuesday's severe storms when the National Weather Service recorded 8 of them. Dallas County saw 1, Calhoun County had 2, and Pocahontas County experienced 3. Buchanan County saw 1, and another passed through Lee, Des Moines, and Henry counties, according to the Weather Service's Des Moines and Quad City bureaus. No injuries reported from the tornadoes. The strongest tornado, an EF2 with winds of about 130 miles an hour, touched down in southeast Iowa in Lee County, just southwest of Houghton, at 4:25 p.m. The 600-yard-wide twister traveled 42 miles before ending at 5:21 p.m. The worst damage was at a farmstead north of New London in Henry County, where a brick house lost its roof. The Dallas County tornado touched down near Minburn in central Iowa at 11:05 a.m. and lasted until 11:15 a.m., according to the Weather Service. It was about 50 yards wide and was on the ground for about 7 miles with wind gusts of 75 to 85 miles an hour. It was rated EF0, the weakest rating. The first Calhoun County tornado touched down near Rockwell City in north-central Iowa at 2:26 p.m. and lasted until 2:38 p.m. It was about 75 yards wide and was on the ground for just over 6 miles, with winds estimated near 100 miles an hour. It was rated at EF1. The second tornado in Calhoun County touched down at 2:57 p.m. near Manson and lasted until 2:59 p.m. It traveled 0.63 miles and was about 30 yards wide. The EF rating and wind speed were unknown because it did not impact any of the damage indicators used to produce the rating, according to the Weather Service. The Buchanan County tornado touched down at 3:02 p.m. northwest of Quasquetan near the Pine Creek Wildlife Area. It traveled 4.3 miles and ended at 3:08 p.m. just west of Winthrop. The wind speed was about 110 miles an hour and the tornado was about 125 yards wide. It was rated EF1. The first Pocahontas County tornado touched down at 3:11 p.m., about 4 miles east of Palmer. It lasted until 3:16 p.m. and traveled just over 2 miles. It was about 50 yards wide. The EF rating and wind speed were unknown. The other two Pocahontas County tornadoes were both near Rolfe and lasted only a few minutes. One touched down between 3:34 and 3:38 p.m. and traveled 1.66 miles. The other touched down between 3:42 and 3:45 p.m. and traveled 0.64 miles. They were both about 40 yards wide. The wind speeds and EF rating of the first were unknown, but the second had an estimated wind speed of 70 miles an hour and an EF rating of 0. Governor Kim Reynolds issued a disaster proclamation for Alma Key, Cass, Des Moines, Fayette, Henry, and Lee counties in response to Tuesday's severe weather. All counties, the governor's office said, suffered significant damage in the storms that not only spawned tornadoes, but also heavy straight-line winds, hail, rain, and flash flooding. The proclamation activates the Iowa Individual Assistance Grant Program and the Disaster Case Advocacy Program for those counties. The Iowa Individual Assistance Grant Program provides grants of up to $5,000 for households with incomes up to 200% of the federal poverty level. Grants are available for home or car repairs, replacement of clothing, or food and temporary housing expenses. Receipts are required for those seeking reimbursement for expenses related to storm recovery. The grant application and instructions are available on the Iowa Department of Homeland Security and Emergency Management website at homelandsecurity.org. iowa.gov/assistance. Potential applicants have 45 days to apply. The Disaster Case Advocacy Program addresses serious needs related to disaster-related hardship, injury, or adverse conditions. Disaster case advocates work with clients to create a disaster recovery plan and provide guidance and referrals. There are no eligibility requirements. It closes after 180 days. See iowacommunityaction.org for details on applying. Much of Linn County is now classified as being in severe drought. Spring rainfall across parts of Iowa has eased drought conditions, relieving all but a sliver of Linn County from the extreme drought that's persisted for months. Just 7.43% of the state is currently classified as being in extreme drought, the second driest of five categories listed by the U.S. Drought Monitor. Last week, extreme drought was reported across 10.55% of the state, all in eastern and northern Iowa. Still, about 85% of Iowa is experiencing some form of drought. The most prevalent are moderate and severe drought, which combine to cover 58.78% of the state. The U.S. Drought Monitor pulls data for its weekly Thursday reports at 8 a.m. each Tuesday. This week's report, which was published Thursday, does not include the rain that fell across the state on Tuesday evening and Thursday. Some parts of eastern Iowa saw more than an inch of rain Tuesday, according to the National Weather Service. Parts of 17 counties in eastern and northern Iowa still are classified as being in extreme drought, including all of Benton, Chickasaw, and Floyd counties. Linn County, which was entirely within the area of extreme drought 1 month ago, now has just 9% extreme drought. 72% of the county is classified as in severe drought, and 17.9% is in moderate drought. Buchanan County, which had been in extreme drought, is down to 10.54% in extreme drought. Despite these improvements, the U.S. Drought Monitor warned that longer-term conditions of 6 months or more are still showing dryness in eastern Iowa. The Iowa City Council this week unanimously approved a proposal to make the Paglia's Pizza building a historic landmark. The council must vote twice more on the designation for the building at 302 to 316 East Bloomington Street before it's official. Besides Paglia's, the property also contains apartments and a laundromat. Though the building's owner is opposed to the designation, council members spoke favorably about being able to preserve a property important to the community. Council member Andrew Dunn said at the Tuesday council meeting that he considered the cultural, historic, and architectural beauty of the building, along with the recommendation of city staff and support from the community for the designation. Council member Josh Moe also voiced his support, saying the process of making something a historic landmark is a slow, deliberate process that happens for rare and only for true exceptional buildings. Several council members were concerned that the designation would infringe on the rights of the property owner, Gary Skarda. Skarda, who last year put the building up for sale, said at the April 2nd council meeting he believes a historic landmark designation will make the building more difficult to sell. Council member Megan Alter said while she was largely in favor of property owner rights, the building still will be sellable and should bring a good price. More than 10 residents spoke in favor of the landmark designation, noting the building's historic and cultural significance. The council also received more than 100 letters of support for the proposal. Some residents spoke against the proposal, saying they felt it was wrong for the city to go against the wishes of SCARTA, and that it would be better for the property to instead be used for the development of new housing. This was the second time the designation has come before the council. At the April 2nd meeting, the proposal required unanimous approval, but was deferred by Mayor Bruce Teague, who said he was having issues with this one. Jordan Sellergren, chair of the city's Historic Preservation Commission, said this is the fourth time the city has considered landmark status for the building. Previous attempts were made in 1980s, 1990s, and in 2015, she said. She said the first two attempts reached the council before failing to proceed, while the 2015 attempt stopped after a letter was drafted to the owner and it did not leave the mailbox. Historic underfunding of state per-pupil aid, the expiration of federal pandemic relief funds, and declining enrollment are factors challenging the Lynn Mar Community School District's fiscal 2025 budget, Superintendent Amy Kortemeyer said. The district is making $2.5 million in budget cuts this year and reducing 50 staff members, including 19 teachers and 31 classified staff, such as paraprofessionals, office workers, custodians, bus drivers, and business managers. Other cuts include early separation agreements with central office staff, including one of the district's two associate superintendents. Individual school building budgets are being reduced by 10%, bringing a cost savings of $112,000, said John Gilbreth, Lynn Mar's chief finance officer. Individual school budgets pay for substitute teachers, office supplies, professional development, and travel to attend training conferences. The 2.5% increase in state supplemental aid next year, the amount of funding taxpayers provide per pupil, is inadequate, Kortemeyer said. Inflation is impacting every sector of the economy, and school districts aren't an exception to that. State aid runs a fiscal year behind. The district's student count in October 2023 will be used to determine funding for the fiscal 2025 budget, which begins July 1st. The Lynn Mar School District saw a decrease of 118 students this school year. About 54 of those students left the district for private school using state-funded tuition assistance, Kortemeyer said. Public school districts receive about $1,200 for every student within their district who uses the state-funded private school tuition assistance, called education savings accounts. Gilbreth said that funding is helpful, but it's restricted to certain uses for particular categories of students, special programs, or special purposes. Lynn Mar's planned general fund expenditures budget is proposed to be $105.5 million, an increase of $2 million from the current fiscal year. The general fund is the largest fund for a school district, with about 80% of it used to pay salaries and benefits for teachers and staff. The district's overall expenditures, however, are decreasing $4.6 million to $148.9 million this fiscal year. This is partly because some of the district's capital improvement projects will be completed or nearly completed in the current fiscal year. Those projects include the tennis courts built at Oak Ridge Middle School, 4901 Elbernett Road in Marion, and the new administration building that district leaders plan to move into by this fall. The move from the Learning Resource Center at Lynn Mar High School will create more space at the school once the move is completed. A public hearing on the proposed budget is scheduled for 5 p.m. Monday at the Learning Resource Center, 2999 10th Street in Marion. The school board is expected to vote on the proposed budget after the public hearing. The proposed budget calls for a levy rate of $17.99 per $1,000 in taxable valuation, about a 10-cent increase from the current rate. For a homeowner with a $200,000 home, the property tax bill for schools would be $1,580 per year, or about $131 a month. One of the contributing factors to the tax levy increase is an additional 35 cents in the management levy, which funds property, liability, and cybersecurity insurance for the district. College Community School Board will hold a public hearing on its proposed 2024-25 budget on Monday. Educators in their first year of teaching and with 12 years' experience will see an increase to their salaries next year under a new bill signed into law by Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds last month. School districts will receive increased funding through the teacher salary supplement to meet these new salary minimums, $50,000 for new teachers by fall of 2025 and $62,000 for teachers with at least 12 years of experience. The teacher salary supplement is per pupil categorical funding to help pay teacher salaries. The challenge for school districts now is to recreate a salary schedule for teachers with in-between levels of experience, said Angie Morrison, Chief Finance Officer for the College Community School District. You can't keep people at the same salary for years, Morrison said. I think most people are thinking everyone will get a $3,000 salary increase, but we're not getting money for that. Currently, new teachers in the College Community School District start at just below $44,000, and 12-year teachers with a bachelor's degree earn $58,000, Morrison said. The new law is great, she says. We want to pay our teachers more. The College Community School District isn't getting very much new money this year, with a 2.5% increase in state supplemental aid next year, the amount of funding provided per pupil, and declining enrollment, Morrison said. The 5,800-student school district declined by 72 children this year. That wasn't something we were expecting. With low state supplemental aid on top of that, the new money we're getting is much lower than what it's been historically, Morrison said. Even so, the district is not planning any reductions to its budget in fiscal 2025, which begins July 1st and ends June 30th, 2025. The district's overall expenditures are increasing about $10 million next fiscal year up to $142.5 million, Morrison said. This is partially because of a $43 million general obligation bond referendum approved by voters in November that will fund the construction of a recreation and wellness center. Morrison said the district is fortunate to be in a strong financial position to weather a year of declining enrollment. But if we saw another 72 students decline next year, we would have to seriously think about some of those things, she said. About 60 students in the College Community School District attendance boundaries are using education savings accounts, private school tuition assistance, to attend private school. Morrison said that could partially account for the decline in enrollment. The district also saw more students open enrolling in and out of the district. District officials feel fairly confident the district won't continue to see a decline in enrollment. A study shows the district's enrollment leveling out before climbing again because of housing developments going up within the school's attendance boundaries. A public hearing on the proposed budget is scheduled for 6:30 p.m. Monday at the College Community School District Administration Offices, 8005 Prairie Spirit Lane Drive in Cedar Rapids. The school board is expected to vote on the proposed budget that same day. Under the proposed budget, property owners in the district would pay a levy rate of $16 per $1,000 of taxable valuation, a 1 cent decrease from the current property tax rate. For a homeowner with a $200,000 home, the property tax bill for schools would be $1,540 per year, or about $128 a month. Michelle Biesker will be the new chief executive officer at Trees Forever, the Marion-based nonprofit, announced on Thursday. Biesker, who begins April 29th, succeeds Kylie Miller, who left last July. Interim CEO Deborah Powers will remain with Trees Forever to help with the transition. Trees Forever works with community leaders and landowners across Iowa, Illinois, and Wisconsin to plant and care for trees and the environment. It's part of a public-private partnership with the City of Cedar Rapids to reforest the city after the August 2020 derecho's winds knocked down about 65% of the city's tree canopy, about 720,000 trees. Biesker most recently served as Senior Vice President of Development at the Greater Cedar Rapids Community Foundation. Additionally, she served as Chief Operating Officer at Waypoint Services in Cedar Rapids, Program Director at Four Oaks in Cedar Rapids, Assistant Vice President at Mount Mercy University, and Global Sales Manager at PMX Industries. Trees Forever said in a news release that Biesker was hired after an extensive search, saying she is a proven leader with expertise in development, community advocacy, strategic planning, and communications. Lynn Montanac, chair of the Trees Forever board, cited Biesker as a leader who understands how to pull together diverse stakeholders to accomplish important things. Michelle is strategic, well-networked, people-focused, and result-oriented. Biesker joins Trees Forever as it launches its Grow the Love campaign to raise money from individuals and smaller businesses toward post-derecho tree replanting. Currently, the organization has reached 61% of the $37 million fundraising goal to replant 42,000 public trees over 10 years. Residents of Cedar Rapids and small businesses will soon be asked to pitch in to Grow the Love and get the city's $37 million fundraising effort across the finish line to replenish the tree canopy lost in the 2020 derecho. Having raised more than half the $37 million needed to plant about 42,000 trees on public rights of way and parks over the course of 10 years, Trees Forever on Saturday will launch a community phase of fundraising for ReLeaf Cedar Rapids, its public-private partnership with the City of Cedar Rapids to revive the city's urban forest. Renowned city planner Jeff Speck helped draft the plan, which was honored last year with a Charter Award, the world's preeminent award for urban design, placemaking, and community building from the Congress for the New Urbanism. The new community-focused capital campaign, Grow the Love, will officially launch Saturday at the annual EcoFest at Nubo City Market. The kickoff at EcoFest comes before Earth Week, which starts with Earth Day, April 22nd, and ends with Arbor Day, April 26th. Fundraising for ReLeaf has been underway for the last 3 years with a focus on major gifts from corporate donors as well as government grants and allocations. Trees Forever has raised $3.5 million. Cedar Rapids committed $10 million, $1 million a year for 10 years, toward the endeavor. In September, U.S. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack announced Cedar Rapids received $6 million through the Inflation Reduction Act. The city also received $3.5 million towards tree planting as part of the U.S. Housing and Urban Development Department's Community Development Block Grant Disaster Recovery Funding. With the Grow the Love campaign, Trees Forever is looking to raise money from individual residents and smaller businesses. Current donations and grants have reached 61% of the $37 million fundraising goal. Now, Cedar Rapids residents are being asked to help push the effort across the finish line. There will be QR codes displayed around the city for people to scan and donate, said Deb Powers, Trees Forever Interim Chief Executive Officer. Powers said if even 5% of all Cedar Rapids residents give at least $10 a month for 3 years, a $360 total, and if local businesses made an average $5,000 a year, 3-year pledge, that could help achieve fundraising goals. We're breaking it down for 3-year pledges so that people can afford to be involved and feel that they're part of this legacy of rebuilding Cedar Rapids, Powers said. Trees Forever hopes to celebrate the campaign's success on August 10th, the 4-year anniversary of the derecho. To contribute to Relief Cedar Rapids or get involved with fundraising and volunteering, visit treesforever.org/relief. With 85% of trees lost being on private land, Trees Forever also is promoting private planting with a variety of programs to assist property owners and organizations. Trees Forever offers community tree distributions twice a year to give 1,000 native trees to Cedar Rapids residents for $20 a tree, Development Director Heather Crosscree said. In 2022, Trees Forever piloted a neighborhood tree captains program to choose 50 volunteers from certain neighborhoods to connect with neighbors and see who wants a free tree. Up to 50 trees are provided. This year, 5 neighborhoods will be selected. On neighborhood planting days, the whole neighborhood comes out and it creates that sense of community as well as gets an entire neighborhood planted in one day. Through the Tree Voucher Program, residents may sign up to take a 1-hour class that teaches people how to plant and care for trees. After completing that class, people receive a gift certificate they can take to a local nursery to purchase a tree off the Relief list of approved native species. The organization's Campus Canopy 10 Plus program helps local businesses, nonprofits, housing associations, or other groups replant. Organizations that need 10 or more trees may apply. Organizations provide volunteers, while Trees Forever brings the trees and the expertise and helps plant trees on the organization's property. Powers said disadvantaged neighborhoods, mobile home courts, and cemeteries are also eligible. This effort considers where there are urban heat islands and where people are more reliant on public transit, and ensure trees are planted at bus stops or along common walking routes. Heat islands are areas with little tree cover and more pavement that capture heat and create heat pockets, posing a threat to public health. The overall plan prioritized which parts of the city would see trees planted first, based largely on equity, identifying socially disadvantaged neighborhoods and areas that have historically lacked trees. It's really important to us to pay attention to that, and we work with the city directly on a massive plan to identify these communities and get trees in the right place, Powers said. Trees Forever really prides itself on right tree, right place, right time. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Friday, April 19th, 2024 on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. Charles Leroy Scharf, 85, of Fayette, passed peacefully on Tuesday morning, April 16th, at Maple Crest Manor in Fayette. The funeral service will be 10:30 a.m. Tuesday, April 23rd, at Grace United Methodist Church in Olwine. Visitation will be from 3 to 7 p.m. Monday at the Jameson Schmitz Funeral Home in Olwine, and for one hour before the service at the church on Tuesday. Interment will be at the Woodlawn Cemetery in Olwine. Memorials and cards may be directed to Karen Scharf, 7397 L Avenue, Fayette, Iowa 52142. Gladys Folkman, 91, of Newhall, passed away on April 18th at the Vinton Lutheran Home. Funeral services will be held on 10:30 a.m. Monday, April 22nd, at St. John Lutheran Church in Newhall. Interment will be at St. John Cemetery near Newhall. Visitation will be held at the church from 2 to 5 p.m. on April 21st. Gladys Marie Rommelsberg was born January 29, 1933, rural Newhall, at home. Gladys was united in marriage to Richard Folkman on December 8, 1954, at St. John Lutheran Church in Newhall. Together they farmed near Newhall until 2012. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be made to Vinton Lutheran Home or St. John Lutheran Church in Newhall. For a non-local obituary, guitar legend Dickie Betts, who co-founded the Allman Brothers Band and wrote their biggest hit, Ramblin' Man, has died. He was 80. The Rock and Roll Hall of Famer died at his home in Osprey, Florida. David Spiro, Betts' manager of 20 years, confirmed. Betts had been battling cancer for more than a year and had chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. Betts shared lead guitar duties with Dwayne Allman in the original Allman Brothers Band to help give the group its distinctive sound and create a new genre, Southern Rock. Acts included Leonard Skinner, Kid Rock, Phish, and Jason Isbell, among many others, were influenced by Allman's music, which combined the blues, country, R&B, and jazz with 60s rock. Tributes came from members of the Allman Brothers Band's extended family. Guitarist Derek Trucks and his wife and bandmate Susan Tedeschi posted on their joint Instagram account that Betts was one of the best ever to do it. Trucks joined the Allman Brothers Band in 1999. His brother Butch Trucks was one of the band's two founding drummers. Founded in 1969, the Allmans were a pioneering jam band, trampling the traditional notion of three-minute pop songs by performing lengthy compositions in concert and on record. The band was also notable as a biracial group from the Deep South. Dwayne Allman died in a motorcycle accident in 1971, and bassist Barry Oakley was killed in a motorcycle crash a year later. That left Betts and Allman's younger brother, Greg, as the band's leaders, but they frequently clashed and substance abuse caused further dysfunction. The band broke up at least twice before reforming and has had more than a dozen lineups. The Allman Brothers Band was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1995 and earned a Lifetime Achievement Grammy Award in 2012. Betts left the group for good in 2000 and also played solo and with his own band, Great Southern, which included his son, guitarist Dwayne Betts. Forrest Richard Betts was born December 12, 1943, and was raised in the Bradenton, Florida area near the Highway 41 he sang about in Ramblin' Man. At 16, he left home for his first road trip, joining the circus to play in a band. He returned home and, with bassist Oakley, joined a group that became the Jacksonville, Florida-based band Second Coming. One night in 1969, Betts and Oakley jammed with Duane Allman, already a successful session musician, and his younger brother, and together they formed the Allman Brothers Band. The group moved to Macon, Georgia, and released a self-titled debut album in 1969. A year later came the album Idlewood South, highlighted by Betts' instrumental composition In Memory of Elizabeth Reed, which soon became a concert staple. The 1971 double album at Fillmore East, now considered among the greatest live albums of the classic rock era, was the Allmans' commercial breakthrough and cemented their performing reputation by showcasing the unique guitar interplay between Allman and Betts. Their styles contrasted, with Allman playing bluesy slide guitar while Betts' solos and singing tugged the band toward country. When layered in harmony, their playing was especially distinctive. The group also had two drummers, Trucks and Jamo Johansson, who is black. Duane Allman died 4 days after Fillmore was certified as a gold record, but the band carried on and crowds continued to grow. The 1973 album Brothers and Sisters rose to number one on the charts and featured Ramblin' Man, with Betts singing the lead and bringing twang to the top 40. The song reached number two on the singles charts and was kept out of the number one spot by Half-Breed by Cher, who later married Greg Allman. Ramblin' Man was the Allman's only top 10 hit, but Betts' catchy 7.5-minute instrumental composition, Jessica, recorded in 1972, became an FM radio staple. Betts also wrote or co-wrote some of the band's other best-loved songs, including Blue Sky and Southbound. In later years, the group remained a successful touring act, with Betts and Warren Haynes on guitar. Greg Allman and Butch Trucks died in 2017. And now on to some sports. Brad Smith's second retirement was longer than his first, but just when he thought he was out for good, the godfather of Iowa high school wrestling coaches was pulled back in for another season. Smith has returned from retirement again as interim head wrestling coach at Clear Creek Amana, filling in for Kyle Fornes, who will miss next season due to obligations as a member of the Army Reserves. The arrangement is expected to be for just the 24-25 season. "He asked me and I said, I've got to ask my wife first," said Smith, the Hall of Fame coach for Lisbon and Iowa City High. "My wife is all for it because it's for a good purpose. He's in the military. I'll do it for one season. I think it's important to support the military and what Kyle's doing." Fornes will be mobilized for a year with some additional responsibilities before it starts. He will serve as a non-commissioned officer in charge. His primary job will be as a medic. Fornes was a 7-year assistant for Smith at City High. He said it was more of a joke when he first asked Smith last summer after he learned of the assignment. While Smith was handing out awards at City High's Bean Smith Duels in January, Fornes mentioned it again, and Smith texted to let him know if he found a substitute. The idea was more reality by the state tournament in February. "Sitting out for 1 year, I missed it," said Smith, who has become a regular pickleball player with his wife about 3 times a week. "You can only play so much pickleball." Iowa's most accomplished wrestling coach, Smith set records with 704 career dual wins and 19 state team titles, including 12 traditional state team crowns, in his 45-year career. He coached 306 state qualifiers to 179 medals and 64 individual championships. Smith, the 1990 National Coach of the Year, coached five of Iowa's 32 four-time state champions. He coached Shane Light from 1987 to 1990 and brothers Carter and Cale Happel, 2013 to 16 and 2017 to 2020, to all four golds at Lisbon. He helped the Lions' Scott Morningstar to his final two titles in 1979 and 80. He did the same for City High's Jeff McGinnis in 92 and 93. Smith inherits a program that has steadily improved. CCA qualified 11 wrestlers for state and competed in the Class 3A regional duels. Smith has run open wrestling room workouts twice a week for about a month before the official announcement. He already started making connections with the wrestlers like Cale Nash and Nolan Howell. Forness and Smith share the same philosophy. The program should be able to maintain the gains it has made under Forness. Smith, who is 70, has benefited from two hip and two knee replacements. He has been on the mat demonstrating technique during workouts. Smith is able and ready to return. I still have a passion for wrestling, and being around kids keeps you young, Smith said. My body is still in pretty good shape, even though I am half bionic. It feels great. The mind is in good shape. We're good to go. It's too early to call it a legacy, but Erin Gerlich already has put her fingerprints on the landscape of girls' high school athletics. Instrumental in the state's rapid growth of girls' high school wrestling, Gerlich was announced Thursday as the next executive director of the Iowa Girls High School Athletic Union. As an Iowa girl, it feels extra special to carry the torch, said Gerlich, 40, who will succeed the retiring Gene Berger on June 8th. We've got a really good staff that is full of good ideas, and I'm deeply honored. A native of Panora, Gerlich came to the union as an associate director in September 2021 after serving as activities director at the Panorama Community School District. She received her undergraduate degree at Iowa State University, her master's in health promotion from Oklahoma State University. Upon her hire at the union, Gerlich's main role was to oversee wrestling, a sport that was IGHSAU sanctioned in time for the 22-23 season. Last season, 3,100 girls participated in wrestling, an increase of more than 20% from the previous year. Gerlich also served as the sport administrator for tennis and has led the IGHSAU Student Athletic Advisory Committee. She will become the union's sixth person, the second woman, in the head role. Berger announced her retirement in February. She had held that role since 2016. Marion girls soccer coach Eric Trilk is a fan of the concept. The Iowa Girls High School Athletic Union and Iowa State University announced Wednesday the Girls State Soccer Tournament will be held in Ames beginning in 2025. The agreement for Iowa State to host the tournament is for 3 years with extension options. I love the idea for a number of reasons, Trilk said. Playing at a state-of-the-art stadium will be a great reward for the teams that make it there, and playing on natural grass that is taken care of will always be better than turf. The Cyclone Sports Complex, home to the Iowa State soccer team, opened in 2013 and holds about 1,500 spectators, with a new video board and system expected to be installed this year. I think it's really great for the girls just getting exposure to Division I schools and what the fields are like, Linmar coach Hannah Clark said. When I played at the University of Iowa, its grass field was amazing. These kinds of colleges keep really nice fields, so it'll be good for the players to play on it. Center Point Urbana coach Kevin Schmidt is a bit more skeptical of the move. The facilities look okay according to Google Maps, but without actually ever stepping foot at the venues, it's hard to know for sure, Schmidt said. It will be a change for sure, and based on the first two rounds being at the Lead Recreation Athletic Center and then the championships being at a completely different space, I'm not sure I'm a fan so far. From an aerial view, the fields at the Lead facility seem very tightly packed. Will there be enough room for fans and everything else that comes with the state tournament? We won't know until 2025 when we're there. Coney Soccer Park in Des Moines will host this year's spring state tournament, as it has every year since 2013, with the exception of COVID-canceled 2020 season. Coney Park, which opened in 1998, consists of 12 natural grass fields and has been used by Drake and Grandview Universities, Des Moines high school teams, and youth programs. One concept is consensus among the three coaches. Playing on a well-maintained grass field is the preferred choice. A 5K race inaugurated last year to raise awareness of Lyme disease is returning to support a new nonprofit started to support the unique needs of Iowans living with the illness. Ticked Off Lyme Foundation, launched earlier this year by founder Tina Rosecrans of Fairfax, will host one of its first fundraisers on June 1st, right after Lyme Disease Awareness Month concludes in May. The 5K race, with an alternate 1K route, hopes to raise more funds to directly help those with the condition in Iowa, while raising awareness among those without it. Rosecrans, who got involved in recognizing Lyme disease after a friend and her child were diagnosed, organized the 5K last year that raised $9,500 for Lyme Warrior, a Virginia-based nonprofit. She and others started organizing local support groups, too. But this wasn't enough, she decided. This year, money raised in Fairfax will stay with the local nonprofit to help Iowans through grants for medical care, which often is not covered by insurance, especially for those who have trouble getting a proper diagnosis. Rosecrans said the fledgling organization, which appears to be the first dedicated to supporting those with Lyme disease in Iowa, hopes to have 100 people in this year's race. For Mindy Libby of Walker, it took years to finally connect the ailments she'd experienced throughout her life because of Lyme disease. Although physicians suspected she had the condition as a young child in the 80s, it wasn't until 2017 that she looked for a doctor that could help make sense of it all. As an adult, she endured flare-ups that seemed more severe than common illnesses, surgeries, and two miscarriages and a stillbirth. Her daughter, now 18, inherited the condition in utero. In 2017, a common cold got so bad that Libby started losing vision and feeling in her face. Occasionally, she also experienced brain fog, which interfered with her ability to work. It was like a yo-yo, she said. Through lifestyle changes and immune system boosts, her Lyme disease has entered dormancy. Colds can cause flare-ups, but she lives a normal life with a manageable condition. Now she hopes to give others the same hope, not only with emotional support, but with financial support to bolster what can be a debilitating condition that interferes with work. With the foundation, our hope is to get people to the point I'm at, to advocate and help others get through the emotions, said Libby, 43. The biggest thing is awareness, to give them awareness in a positive light. And we end with a Gazette editorial, "The camera bill is better than a ban." Automated traffic enforcement cameras have been in place and entering and exiting the S-curve in Interstate 380 in Cedar Rapids for nearly 14 years. They ceased to be a contentious local issue years ago. No city elected official lost a seat due to camera discontent. But the cameras in Cedar Rapids and elsewhere have been a hot topic for years at the State House. There have been bills filed that ban the use of cameras and some measures that would place them under state oversight, but the legislature couldn't come to a consensus. That changed this week when the Iowa Senate sent House File 2681 to Governor Kim Reynolds. The legislation would mandate that local governments seek a permit from the Iowa Department of Transportation before installing a camera system on state highways and interstates. Cities with existing camera systems, such as Cedar Rapids and Marion, would have to apply for state approval. Cedar Rapids will again need to prove cameras on the I-380S curve are justified. Cedar Rapids, faced with the threat of a ban, testified to lawmakers that the likelihood of an S-curve crash causing injuries was cut in half and total collisions declined 15%, thanks to the cameras. The bill would require that automated cameras be installed in high-risk areas, with cities providing data showing how cameras make those areas safer. The bill also limits fines for vehicles traveling more than 10 miles an hour over the speed limit. Cameras in Cedar Rapids and Marion already exceed that threshold. For cities under 20,000 population, cameras can only issue warnings, not fines. Lawmakers are targeting small towns that have set up cameras on nearby stretches of interstates and highways with questionable effect on roadway safety. The compromise bill stopped attempts by lawmakers to ban cameras. A House amendment banning cameras failed on a 47-50 vote. Camera opponents have long complained that the systems are about raising revenue, not safety. City officials across the state have insisted that that's not true, but the revenue can be significant. For fiscal 2025, according to the City of Cedar Rapids, the budgeted revenue from traffic cameras is $7.2 million. Of that total, nearly $5.5 million will fund 41 police officer positions, while the ATE service provider and collection costs will top $1.7 million. We hope the bill blocks further talk of banning cameras. That's unlikely, but at least this compromise applies the brakes. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Friday, April 19th, 2024. I'm your reader, Grace Barter. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening. Thank you.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is EarthDate.
What exactly is fossil water, and why have we consumed so much of it? No, it's not a new brand of bottled water imported from the days of dinosaurs. Fossil water came from melting ice sheets, ancient lake systems, and a generally wetter climate tens to hundreds of thousands of years ago. It percolated into porous rocks, which were then buried under deep layers of sediment, where it was sealed off from the surface, and there it stayed, until farmers discovered it. And in the second half of the 20th century, they started drilling wells into fossil aquifers and pumping like mad, turning sunny, dry places into acres and acres of green farmland. Crop supplies boomed, food became cheaper and more plentiful, grown in formerly parched places like California and Kansas, and shipped around the world for people like you and me to eat, ingesting fossil water with it. The trouble is, fossil water is a finite resource, and new studies suggest that many fossil aquifers may become depleted this century, so that we won't be able to rely on them any longer. This could mean that the crops that depend on them could become less plentiful and more expensive again. All the while, population will likely increase, the climate will likely warm, our demand for water will continue to climb, which means we'll have to adapt to the lack of fossil water, just as we adapted to its discovery, this time with more efficient crops and farming methods and more efficient use. For EarthDate, I'm Scott Tinker.
EarthDate is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more EarthDate stories at earthdate.org.
Are you among the millions of Americans living with chronic pain? If so, you may think prescription opioids are the solution. The truth is, the benefits of opioids are limited. Opioids only mask the pain. Opioids also come with serious side effects, ranging from nausea to withdrawal symptoms to overdose. As many as 25% of people who are prescribed opioids struggle with addiction. And those who are addicted to opioids are 40 times more likely to move on to heroin. No one wants to live in pain, but no one should put their health at risk to be pain-free. There is another choice: physical therapy. Physical therapists treat pain through movement and exercise, no warning labels required, and you get to be an active participant in your care. Choose to treat your pain safely. Choose physical therapy. Visit moveforwardpt.com to find a physical therapist near you. This public service announcement is brought to you by the American Physical Therapy Association.